Okay, so thank you very much. This is going to be a scary ride for some of us, but I'll see what I can do. So thank you very much, Luca, for that introduction. Thank you very much to all of you for your patience for this slightly different presentation. I'm very pleased to be with you in spirit, if not in body. I'm sitting here looking over the sea. I'll show you. Here we are. This is, I'm not sure whether you can see this. I'm trying to now get my slides to move on. Okay, can you, my slides are not moving on, is that right? You're not seeing anything different? Okay, let me just, I'm having a slight problem now. See if we can. Okay, has the slide moved on?
I have to give you again the permission.
Yeah, sorry,
So
it didn't.
now, please click again on the icon of your screen.
I've done that now. Okay.
We don't see the slides. So you see the okay now, and launch
Good.
now. Start to scroll the slides.
Do you see a nice picture?
Now we see. Yes, wonderful.
Okay. Okay, so if you look carefully, you'll see me at the top of that cliff. That's where I'm speaking from. Not quite, but this is, so I'm in my parents' hometown, looking after my father, who has dementia. And because of an accident to my mother, he's in a nursing home, and we're taking him out tomorrow. And it's a very good example, I think, of somebody who is has a lot of health problems and is very unhappy with his current situation. So I will not use that experience in my presentation, but I want to do is to talk about these things here. And Luca, you're going to tell me. Just let me check. This is showing my six sections for the talk. Can you see that? Good.
Perfect.
Okay. All right.
Perfect.
Good. I will just assume everything is visible now. So what I want to do is talk a bit about quickly about mental illness and what it means. Something about the intersection between mental illness and well-being. But I'm very conscious that we have Carol Riff speaking after me, and there's nothing I can say that will get close to her expertise in this area. So I just want to set the scene. And then I'm going to focus on what I've called economic drivers, some of the economic experiences that people have which seem to be associated with mental illness. Certainly then some of the economic consequences, and then how societies can and should respond in appropriate ways, particularly if we look at mental illness through a well-being lens, particularly a broadly defined well-being lens. And then I'll just finish very briefly with some policy imperatives which bring together some of these discussions. So that's my plan. So first of all, some basic parameters about mental illness. What I put on the slide here, it's a slide I use a lot in presentations. It just describes the situation on any single day in a typical high-income country like Switzerland or the UK, where you would have maybe one in six of the population who have some symptoms of mental illness, but perhaps not reaching a severity that gives them a disorder, such as sleep problems or fatigue or worry. And then another, about a sixth, who will have common mental disorders, and those will be symptoms that actually reach the threshold of diagnosis. And the most common, as I'll show you in a moment, are depression and anxiety. And then you've got a small proportion of the population who have severe mental illness, so that would include schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, manic depression, and serious depression. About 1 or 2%, maybe 2 or 3%, perhaps I would change that slide. And then just under two-thirds of the population on any single day will be symptom free. So we're talking about quite high proportions, and the image I'll use throughout the talk of 1 in 4 comes from the suggestion that 1 in 4 of the population in the UK, and I imagine it's the same in Switzerland, will experience a mental illness at some point during a single year. So we're talking about a substantial degree of morbidity and therefore consequences probably for well-being. Now, the slide at the moment refers to a working age population, so-called working age. If I then just extend it, I put up there some figures for children. 6%, for example, of children at any particular point will be having behavioural problems. I'll come back to illustrate some of the consequences of those later. 4% emotional problems. 1% I've just put down autism. There are many other conditions as well. And then for older people, prevalence of dementia is indicated there, quite a high prevalence, and you can see that the prevalence doubles every 5-year age group. So when you get to a substantial portion of the population in many countries today are reaching ages above 80, above 90, then we're going to see many people with dementia in that population. So that's the basic epidemiology. A bit more about the impact of that epidemiology on people's lives. And this slide comes from the Global Burden of Disease study by Chris Murray and others, and is focused on the UK because I have that one readily to hand. And what you can see on the horizontal is different age bands from 0 to 6 days on the left to greater than 80 years on the right. And in the vertical, you've got the extent of the disability that's related to health problems. And Chris Murray's group have particular ways to measure disability, and there's been discussion about that. But I think the slide is very helpful. And it's helpful because if you look at that area, if you can think my mouse is probably showing you now, that red area, substantial area in the middle, that is mental and behavioral disorders. And the sort of peachy colour underneath it, which is quite high here in the over 80 age group, that's neurological disorders, which would include dementia. And if I just put on that little yellow circle to highlight the fact that a large number of mental health problems are starting early in life, and in those early adulthood years, in the adolescent and adult years, early adulthood years, mental health problems contribute a huge proportion of the overall disability-related consequences of poor health. So we're talking about problems which start quite early in life, and this next slide gives us an indication of that. So it's suggested that again, this would apply to high-income countries, although it's not so very different in other parts of the world, that about 50% of lifetime mental illness has started by the age of 14, and that three-quarters has started by by the mid-20s. So we're talking about conditions which begin to have their impact, often their most severe impact sometimes, at ages when people are investing in their human capital, investing in personal relationships, investing in lots of ways. And so it's not surprising that there are concerns about the consequences of mental illness over the life course. Now, one more quick slide on this basic epidemiology, just to explain what we mean by mental health problems, mental illness. And this is again from the Global Burden of Disease study. And the height of each of those lines indicates the extent of the disability. And this is now distinguishing different mental illnesses. So the most prevalent one, and it's this line at the top here, this blue line on my computer at least, is depressive disorders, the most common and disabling when you aggregate up across the population. This one down here, this sort of brown colored one, is anxiety disorders, and this one here is drug use disorders. There are many others, and those three I've just highlighted are not necessarily the most distressing or disabling or upsetting of conditions that happen to be the most prevalent, but we can see substantial consequences, and particularly consequences in early adulthood, which is when some of these mental health problems really do have their biggest impact. Okay, so having left, just quickly set the scene in terms of epidemiology, let me then think a bit about well-being. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail here because I want to illustrate some of the consequences in a moment. But I just want to start, first of all, by putting on the slide here what we would see typically if you went back over the last 50 years or so, 50 or 60 years of research in the mental health area. These would be typically the measures you would see to indicate either the consequence of a mental illness for an individual, or the outcome dimensions that might be used in an evaluative study, for example. So you've got from the top there the most clinical elements, the symptoms, the extent of disability, linked to needs. You're then moving through some social functioning and self-care abilities, then beginning to look at people's occupation and employment, perhaps looking at their behavioural characteristics. So, you know, where my father is at the moment in a nursing home, some of the behavioural characteristics associated with dementia, if you don't know about them, they're pretty horrible, and it's also causing him such distress. So many health problems, mental health problems, can have these externalising behaviours, which can be upsetting for lots of people, including the person with them. And then down the bottom there, I put down quality of life, and I've called that condition specific because over the course of 50, 60 years, services and researchers have started to use a broader well-being concept in their measurement, but it tends to be condition defined, so dementia specific or schizophrenia specific, etc. And then there's some other measures on there, which you would find in many of these studies. And then more recently, what we've seen developing has been a focus on generic health-related quality of life measures. The QALY and the DALY are the two that come readily to mind, used more in research than in everyday service practice, of course, but trying to then take us, I would say, to a slightly more generalized sense of well-being, not so directly tied to the condition or the disease that's being looked at. Now, that's taking us some distance, but what we need to do is to move beyond that. And what has happened in the research literature and the conceptual literature has been a discussion of a number of things. This slide, I have to say, is caused me most anxiety in putting together, because I know that Carol Riff is there and she is one of the key, obviously, international experts in this area. So let me just briefly say my understanding of what's happened in the mental health field, and then move on to another measure which tries to embody some of these broader well-being concepts. So at the top of the slide, what you've got there is this emphasis on patient-reported, patient-rated outcome measures, and I've put especially health-related quality of life, even in severe mental illnesses. Now, in a way, it's perhaps ironic that when I look across the health services research literature, in the mental health area, patient-reported or user-reported measures have been used for a very long time, quite possibly longer than in many other clinical areas. So this is not a big revolution in mental health, it's been there for a long time. What we've seen, though, moving to the second bullet point and third bullet point, is a greater willingness and a greater interest in trying to link mental illnesses to even broader concepts of well-being, either hedonic, the life satisfaction type measure, or eudaimonic, deeper psychological or emotional well-being, which I'll come back to in a moment. Now, what we know from the work of Richard Layard and others, for example, colleagues at the LSE, Richard's written a number of times that mental illness is the single most important determinant of misery. people with mental illness experience very poor psychological well-being, poor life satisfaction in that hedonic sense. What Carol, I'm sure, is going to talk about a bit later on this morning will be a wider concept, a eudaimonic well-being, and I'm going to link to that in a moment on my next slide. Now, what we've also had in the mental health area is a very interesting debate linked, associated particularly with Corey Keyes in the US, who I know has worked with Carol Riff in the past, who proposes this concept of flourishing, where people have high levels of emotional, psychological, and social well-being, and it's obverse, it's the other end of the spectrum will be where people are languishing rather than flourishing. And on the next slide, I've just copied over a figure from one of Corey Key's papers a few years ago now, which emphasizes that in his interpretation, mental illness and mental health are different dimensions, which of course is causes a bit of confusion terminologically wise, but what he refers to then is this concept of languishing or flourishing, and that people who are experiencing mental illness in a conventional clinical sense could nevertheless be flourishing for reasons that I'll come on to in a moment. So I think it begins to very, I think, helpfully, and Carol Riff's work has done this as well, helpfully separate the clinical concern with illness with the psychological, emotional well-being concern with better mental health, better well-being. Now, I want to use a slightly different framework for understanding well-being in what I'm going to say from now on, which is this in now discussed in the mental health field for 25 years or so, more than 20 years, associated with the work of Bill Anthony in the States originally. But this is a concept that in a number of countries, certainly in the UK, has really taken off. And I put quite a long quote there from Bill Anthony just to explain what it is. I'm not going to read the whole quote out. But the important thing is that recovery from mental illness involves much more than recovery from the illness itself. It is about this wider set of well-being concepts, psychological well-being, emotional, social well-being. What we see now in services, not all services by any means, but in a growing number of services, is recognition that mental illness treatment is not just about getting rid of the symptoms, although that would help, but it is about giving people hope and opportunities and purpose and generally allowing them to take more control of their lives and take more control of the objectives in their lives. So that concept of recovery is proving to be quite influential in designing services in some settings, and I'm going to now reflect on it in some of the evidence that we've got. Now, before I do that, just a couple of things I took from the very helpful website of the Mental Health Foundation, which is a charity in the UK, on what supports recovery, and I think this helps to explain what the concept means. So from an evidence point of view, what they would argue is important is good relationships, financial security, personal growth, being able to develop your own perspectives, developing resilience, those sorts of things. And their argument is there's good evidence from robust research which suggests that those things would support recovery in the way that they and other people have defined it. And then there are some other factors which they would separate, saying they're more developed from personal experience rather than perhaps robust research, but nevertheless important. People being believed in, being listened to and understood, getting explanations for the problems they're experiencing, and opportunities actually just to hand over responsibility to somebody else. That is all part of recovery, and it's why I think in the mental health field we do have such difficulty sometimes in designing our services, designing our research to properly reflect the objectives that people wish to pursue. So that's the sort of basic approach to well-being that I think I want to use as I go through and identify some of the evidence that's relevant. So let me move on to the third section then, which is economic drivers of mental illness. And I put on the slide here the sort of main driving factors that we would expect to see in a mental health context. So we've got, obviously, in this area, as in every area of health, a rapidly developing field of work which is trying to understand the genetic basis for mental illnesses. I used to joke 25 years ago that there are lots of people chasing a Nobel Prize for discovering the schizophrenia gene. Nobody's found it yet, and nobody's going to find it. What we know is that genetics are clearly important in influencing mental illness, but there's a huge amount of variability associated with the environment. So heritability may be accounting for 25% of variation in a few conditions, but generally speaking, environment is very important. So the environmental drivers, although demography is not really an environmental driver, but demography is important, but the drivers that are more lifestyle based, there's trauma, the experience of trauma, which we now understand can have long, very long term impacts over the life course. There are lifestyle choices, such as cannabis, which we know is associated at high levels of consumption with psychosis. There are long term conditions, people's physical health, I'm not going to say more about that. And there are also other lifestyle choices I put there. There are things like breastfeeding, child will affect child behavior. So a number of factors that are coming in to affect mental illness. And at the bottom of the slide there, I put economic conditions. And I just want to quickly show you some evidence on the links between the state of the economy or the individual economic experiences of families and the onset or exacerbation of mental health problems. So things like poverty, unemployment, sickness, absence, we know are associated with one causal direction or another mental illness. We know that mental illness is exacerbated during recession, and it seems to be exacerbated when governments decide not to spend as much on health as many of us would like. But the effects run in both directions, and that's the complexity to bear in mind. So let me just quickly, in the interest of time, just go on to some evidence. Now, this study here by Scott Wyke and Glyn Lewis, many years ago now, quite an old study, it was one of the first studies to look at the link between economic circumstances, poverty, unemployment, common mental disorders, poverty, unemployment, and mental disorders. And what they found was that there was a connection, but it wasn't as strong as people had previously suggested. And the reason for that, I think, was because they were looking at longitudinal data rather than cross-sectional data. Now, today, we would see this as a no-brainer. Of course, we'd want to have longitudinal data over time. But this was not very common at the time of the research that they were doing. So they found that poverty and unemployment were associated with the maintenance of mental health problems, mental illness, but not with the onset, and the relationship was weaker than previously found. Now that's an interesting result. What they also have in the paper is just a sentence, really, not much more than that, which is pointing to this connection to financial strain or debt is independently associated with both onset and maintenance of mental illness, even after adjusting for the poverty level, the standard of living the individual has. So we have some economic drivers of mental illness. It's not necessarily poverty which is the driver, and nobody wants to be poor, and I'm not proposing that that's a good thing, but it's not necessarily poverty which is bringing on mental health problems. It's uncontrolled, unsecured debt, which is particularly a problem. Okay, so that's one study. Another study, which I think is quite interesting, is an old study from Finland looking at an earlier time when there was a major economic recession there. And what they did was look at 12-year-olds and their parents, And the links again between economic conditions and mental illnesses. And what they found was that a reduction in the family income increased the risk of child mental health problems. So you would expect from the previous slide and other research that there might be a connection to adult mental health problems, depression, but it seems there's a problem with child mental illness as well. And then two more studies to talk about quickly. One is this study, and actually a number of recent studies now from the US, which have shown the association between the state of the economy and the use of soft and hard drugs and the use of alcohol, and also suggesting that during times of economic difficulty, macroeconomic difficulty, there's more drug dealing by teenagers. So again, a link running from economic difficulties now to mental illness and behaviors associated with mental illness. And then I often ask my students whether they think that during an economic recession, alcohol consumption goes up or down. The economists say it goes down, the psychologists say it goes up. The evidence is both. It seems that during recession, heavy drinkers drink less and light drinkers drink more. Again, though, an association linked to the economic conditions to behaviors that we know are associated with mental illness issues. And then the final example of this is an example that's attracting lots of attention now in the research literature and in governments, which is the association between economic difficulties and suicide. Now, suicide is a very extreme outcome measure for mental health problems. There are many other factors that many other outcomes we would like to look at. But suicide just happens to be the one indicator that we have routinely available in national statistics, and so it gets lots of attention. What you can see from this is a slide for England, and it shows employment and suicide trends for women at the top of the picture, men at the bottom. The link for men is perhaps the strongest, and what you can see, that blue line showing unemployment, how it trended over the period from 2000, and then the dotted red line shows you the trend in suicides. Now notice that suicide trend had been falling quite considerably over a period of 7-8 years, which was a deliberate, real strong policy push. And yet when the global recession started to have its impact, at least in England, in 2007, 2008, what we saw was this increase in suicide rates. And that's been shown in many other studies. Now, this slide is way too complicated to look at. I'm going to show you a highlighted version in a moment. But this is a study by a group of researchers who compared suicide rates in 2009 with the trend over the previous years. And in all of the countries that they were looking at, pretty much all of the countries, suicide rates had been falling over the previous decade, and they were interested to know what was the impact of the recession, perhaps, on suicide in 2009. And this slide here is just a highlighted version of the one I've just shown you, and these two areas here show you the p-value for the test comparing 2009 actual with 2009 predicted from that trend over previous years. And you can see for men on the left, significant, highly significant difference between the real suicide rate and what would have been predicted. For women, much less of an impact, just one or two countries where that was a significant difference. So it seems that economic recession is having an impact, has an impact on male suicide rates particularly. Okay, now let me go then to economic consequences of mental illness, and I'm just going to do this quite briefly because I'm conscious of time. So what do we know about the consequences? We know that mental illness can have impacts on well-being in that, either in that narrow sense of health-related quality of life, or in the wider sense of hedonic and eudaimonic and flourishing and recovery-based measures. We know of those consequences, and I'll show you some responses we need to have in a moment. We see impacts on economic and social exclusion, on crime, on early death, on transmission, which I'll show you in a moment, and on discrimination, which I also want to say something about. So, first of all, two slides. I'll show you this one and just hint at the second one from the OECD, who've done some very good work on mental illness across OECD countries. And what this slide shows you is the employment rate for people with mental health problems. And in each of the countries, you've got three columns. So let me just concentrate on Norway on the left. The lowest column is people with severe disorder, where you can see an employment rate of around about 58%. The medium column, middle column rather, is moderate disorder, unemployment around 75%, and no disorder, unemployment around 82%. So you've got this clear gradient which applies across all of these countries that they were able to get data for, and has been found in other countries too. So we know there is that relationship between mental illness and employment. And the second slide from the OECD, which is now poverty rates, it's the same sort of situation. The colours, in these are their colours, and they don't distinguish terribly well between severe and no disorder. But severe disorder on the left shows in the US here, for example, a very high poverty rate, 43%, for moderate disorder, around 24%, for people without a mental disorder, around about 17%. Now, within these populations, these people could have any number of physical health problems. Those are not being partialed out from the study. It's just saying that when you do adjust for other conditions, poverty is much more prevalent in people with severe disorder. And what you can see from these countries as well is that countries like the US and to some extent the UK and Australia appear to have less generous welfare systems than some other countries, in that when people are out of work, they seem to get less support from the welfare state. That's maybe for debate. Okay, so that's two of the economic consequences. The third consequence would be that mental illness can have big economic impacts on family and other unpaid carers. This is just a cost of illness study for dementia in the UK, and you can see that nearly a half of the total cost of dementia is associated with unpaid care, quite a substantial element. Let me go to the other end of the age spectrum and look at this. Also, this transmission impact, the link between mental illness and economics. This is a slightly complicated slide which shows you the effect of maternal mental illness, so mother being mentally ill, particularly in this case depression, either during pregnancy or in the first year after the baby is born. And this shows you the odds ratios for the child developing mental health problems. So, for example, in the left-hand column, if the child's mother was depressed during that perinatal period, then the child has nearly a 7 times higher risk of developing emotional problems before they reach the end of their teenage years. They have a nearly 4 times higher risk of conduct problems, externalizing behavior problems, which can be enormously damaging. They have a nearly 3 times higher risk of a lower IQ, with one or two other factors coming in to be influential on that. So we can see the impact now again of mental illness, in this case on somebody else's mental illness. And then from that same study, what you can see here then is the costs following from the mother's mental health problems, the costs as channeled, if you like, through the child's emotional, behavioral and cognitive problems. And in those columns, and if I was going to do the slide again, I would change them, but I didn't have time. But what you've got is in purple some public sector costs, in yellow the productivity losses for these children of the mothers when they reach working age, as well as the mother's productivity loss. And then this larger blue part of the column, which is a monetized measure of the quality of life impact. Perhaps not the best way to show that, but at least you can see there is, again, quite a substantial transmission from in this case, one person's mental health problems to another person's mental health problems, and then to that other person's well-being. And then my final area of impact in economic terms of, well, in economic terms for the moment, is in stigma. And I've just copied here some newspaper articles which demonstrate how responsibly and empathetically some of our media describe mental illness, describing people with mental health problems as bonkers, which in the English language would not be seen as a particularly supportive term. So what you've got here is, you know, difficulties with attitudes of mental illness, how media deal with mental illness, and we know that there are strong links between those attitudes and social exclusion, and thence to well-being. And that's especially problematic when stigma affects people early in life. And one of the big problems that people with behavioral and emotional problems have is bullying, either in school or in the workplace, and that can lead to all sorts of well-being difficulties. The response to that has been these examples. This is the English anti-stigma campaign and the Scottish anti-stigma campaign. So there are attempts to address this, but this is a major and ongoing societal issue. Now, let me just show you a consequence of that stigma as my final example of these impacts, and then go on to some life course. This shows you, first of all, let me just point out what these mean. These lines show you the unemployment rate of people without mental health problems and top people with mental problems. The EU countries' unemployment went up in the period of the recession from 2006 to 2010. It went up faster for people with mental health problems than people without. So we've got this disadvantage that I've shown you before, and it's particularly problematic. It gets more problematic during a recession. But what we also found, and we looked at the attitudes that people had to mental illness in each of those EU countries, and what we found was that recession not only widened the gap in the unemployment rate, but it also widened the gap even more in countries where stigmatizing attitudes were strongest. So mental illness is not good for your employment rate. Recession is even worse for your employment rate if you're mentally ill, and stigmatizing attitudes exacerbate the problem even more. So stigma is a major driver of social and economic inclusion and of well-being. Okay, then let me just show you then the final little examples in this section. Would be about the long-term links between mental illness and some economic consequences, and two studies just that I have done myself that I just want to use to illustrate that. So one is a study which looked at 10-year-olds in a part of London in 1970. Michael Rutter conducted the study, done lots of very important work in this area. And what we did was to go back to his data and look at the 10-year-olds when they had reached the ages of 26 to 28. And we focused on three groups for that: 10-year-olds who had no problems at school, no mental health problems, no clinical diagnosis, those who had antisocial behavior at school, so they were a nuisance at school but didn't reach a threshold for disorder, and those with a disorder. And I'm going to show you what happened to them in terms of their service use in that period of 18 years. And the cost of those services. So the children with no problems, no mental health problems, had these costs over that 18-year period, and you can just about see the colours in that column. You've got education, special education, that is, costs, a little tiny slither of health costs, social care, relationships, welfare benefits, and criminal justice. And then we go to the group of children who were exhibiting difficult behaviour in school, but they didn't reach a threshold for a clinical diagnosis. And you can see their costs are much higher. And then we get to the group who do reach that threshold for diagnosis, although they may not have been diagnosed, and certainly in 1970, child and adolescent mental health services would not have been very widely available, not have been very effective, I would say. What you can see over that period is a substantial connection running through from these mental health problems at age 10 to the costs to the state by age 28, but also reflected in that benefits would pick up on poor employment, relationships are about divorce, criminal justice would include a lot of substance misuse, so a whole range of other consequences. And then a second example, which is a similar study, also actually from starting in 1970, which is one of the birth cohort studies. And what we did was follow up the children born in 1 week in April 1970 up to age 30 and looked at the connections between their mental health condition at age 10 and their employment, their earnings, and their income by age 30. So our analysis of the data at age 10, we did various principal component analyses and identified three main mental health characteristics: antisocial conduct, attention deficit problems, and anxiety. And then we looked at those indicators there at the bottom, whether people were in a job or not, economically active or inactive, the status of their job, the sort of height, the quality of the job, if you like, and therefore its earnings, which was the third characteristic, and then the expected earnings, which is multiplying the probability of being in a job by the actual weekly or monthly earnings. And what I've summarized on the slide here then is the main findings for those three mental health conditions, and I'll just put a circle around the one that we might not expect. But generally speaking, what you see, for example, if you take anxiety, that girls who are anxious at age 10 have worse, significantly worse economic outcomes by age 30. For attention problems, it's uniformly bad for boys and for girls. But for antisocial conduct, it's interestingly different. It seems that boys who have conduct problems at age 10 have a lower probability of being in a job, but if they are in a job, they earn considerably more than, well, not considerably, they earn significantly in the statistical sense more than the average you would expect given their other characteristics. So sometimes mental health problems are not taking us in the direction we might expect. I usually ask my students why they think these results arise, and in the old days students would say, well, they, people with conduct problems are perhaps working in high risk industries like the building industry or stockbrokers or share in stock markets. Nowadays they often talk about bankers, but something about behavior at age 10 which is slightly aggressive and antisocial appears to give you better earnings by age 30. The evidence suggests it doesn't continue beyond much beyond that early adulthood. Shouldn't be in there. Let me just go back to this slide. I showed you this slide before. I just want to put on here a bit more information. That early years period is very important. The difficulty is that in many countries, and these figures in the top right-hand corner are from England, in many countries we have very low treatment rates. So if you look at the bottom of that little box, I've put there that 58% of people aged 66 to 74 are treated. 58% of people with a mental health problem have it treated. That for ages 26 to 65, it's about 45%, but for the younger age groups, it's noticeably smaller. So even though this is the period when mental health problems are first emerging, when mental health problems can be most damaging in terms of symptoms and consequences for your future life chances, it is the age when we do worst in terms of identifying people and treating them. And the consequences then will be huge and will last for very long periods. So poor educational outcomes, low employment rates. Alyssa Goodman's done very good research up to the age of 50 showing significant impact on family income. We see higher death rates from suicide, from homicide, from people with poor mental health, often associated poor health behaviours. And at the bottom of that slide, what I've noted is what we now have, a very unwelcome statistic that suicide is the biggest killer of males aged under 50 in England today. So huge consequences of not identifying and treating these problems.
Martin?
And we also know in the other direction, some interesting results published recently by a group of people at the Institute of Psychiatry, which show very long consequences of bullying at ages 7 or 11 through to age 50 in terms of higher rates, much higher rates of depression, anxiety, and suicidal ideation by that time.
Martin.
Okay, let me move to my final main section, which is on how we respond. And I'm not going to go into great detail here because we haven't got much time left. So there are two types of responses I think we want to see from a healthcare system. One would be trying to prevent many of these mental illnesses from occurring in the first place. I'm not going to go through what's on the slide here, but doing things, there are lots of things that can be done, lots of things that countries are trying to do, I would say, to try to head off these problems in the first place and thereby have major impacts, I would hope, on well-being over the life course. So a whole range of things in the prevention domain. Secondly, what we can do is then think about when people do have mental illnesses to treat them more effectively, more appropriately. And I'm just going to show you a couple of slides from the study that we conducted and published 2 years ago now called Investing in Recovery. And what we did was a whole bunch of very simple economic decision models to examine the economic case for ways to improve the chances of recovery in the way I defined it earlier, focusing on people with psychosis, so that would be mainly schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And we know that psychosis, as I said earlier, occurs or begins to show itself early in life, in adolescence mainly, and early adulthood. So we did a set of quick and ugly, as I would call them, models of a different set of, let me just go to this, a set of interventions. And I've listed them on the slide there, 15 interventions that we looked at where there appeared to be evidence of effectiveness already, and we wanted to see whether there was an economic case. I'm not going to summarize what the economic case was. In most cases, what we had was a clear signal from the narrow cost effectiveness point of view, a clear signal to decision makers that these were sensible things for them to consider. So what these interventions might mean, which are focused, not necessarily focused on alleviating the clinical symptoms of mental illness, but they're focused on improving the mental health in a well-being sense of people who experience mental illness. And there are things like peer support, things like self-management, crisis services, when people are going through a crisis of severe mental illness symptoms, how to respond in ways that people would find to be appropriate and ways that they would perhaps choose before that crisis occurs. There are things like here, individual placement and support, which is a very structured way of getting people with mental illnesses into employment and supporting them when they're there. Down the bottom here, we've got things like anti-stigma campaigns, personal budgets, giving people control over the budgets that pay for their services, or some control, giving people welfare advice, a whole range of things. So what we found from that study, I'm not going to give you the detail, is that many of these interventions generated savings to the healthcare system. Many of them generated savings elsewhere. Some did not appear to generate savings. They didn't cut the costs by delivering the services, but they were still cost effective in an economic sense, and I put there by NICE criteria, which is the framework that will be used by the health service in England to consider whether something is cost effective. And all of them demonstrated the potential to support recovery and improve well-being. So with a well-being framework for looking at mental illness services, there are things that we can do which are both effective and cost effective. Okay, my final couple of slides will be policy imperatives. Now, if I just go to what I've tried to say, and I've just put them quickly onto the slide here about mental health problems or mental illness, I think they're gloriously complex. There's high prevalence, they start early in life, they last usually for a lifetime. There are very, very few cures of mental illnesses. There are no simple genetic explanations, so environment is really important. They're associated with widespread stigma and discrimination. They have these complex links to well-being. In that third block of bullet points on the slide, we know that mental illness is associated with a high risk, in some cases, of suicide and self-harm, of antisocial behavior, and that leads to, I haven't talked about it, compulsory detention in some cases. So we have a set of characteristics that are associated with mental illness, which I think make mental illness stand out from most other health problems that I can think of in having that very peculiar and challenging combination of features. And what does that mean in terms of the policy responses that we need? Well, if we just go back to our 1 in 4, and just to say, what would we want to see our policy responses being? I think what we want policymakers to do is to recognize the complex etiology of mental illnesses and to make a commitment, as many of them are now beginning to do, perhaps still needs to be a greater commitment to prevention and risk reduction. So that's one set. Secondly, we want our healthcare systems to offer a wide range of treatments when people do get ill, and we want them to be evidence-based, of course. We want the commitment to parity with physical health, which is simply not happening across the world. Mental health is still not treated in the same way as physical health in almost every country. It's the poor relation. It gets less resources than it should do. And when we have got services, to break down the real or perceived barriers to access to those services. There's a need for policy to take a life course perspective, given what we know about mental illness. It needs to take a multi-sector perspective. It needs to involve families and communities. It particularly needs to address the stigmatizing attitudes, the people who experience mental health problems. Often the biggest damage to their well-being is not the symptom set that they experience, it's the response of society to them and to their symptoms, which is so impactful in terms of well-being. And then finally, what we want to do, if we think about mental illness in terms of promoting well-being and a recovery approach, we want to see policymakers extending opportunities, choice and control to offer meaning and purpose and hope to people who experience mental illnesses, and especially to emphasize well-being. And on that note, I will stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Martin.